We pause, O Lord, and we thank you for your loving grace. And Father, we dedicate this time to you also, that we might hear with open ears, that we might share with open hearts, and that we may trust you, Lord, to be our guide, as you have always done so. We thank our brother Steve as he has come to share with us and to help us understand a lot of changes within the church. So don't leave us yet. Be with us, we pray, in your Son, Jesus. Amen.
Amen. So what I'm going to do briefly, as you heard from my sermon, brief is hard in this because it's a complicated topic, but we'll get there, is talk about the decision-making structures of the United Methodist Church and kind of give a quick context. And that is to say that currently in the United Methodist Church, General Conference is the legislative body that modifies the Book of Discipline. The Book of Discipline contains what other organizations would call the bylaws of the church. So in a congregational system, every congregation writes its own bylaws. In a Roman Catholic system, the Vatican writes the bylaws. And in a United Methodist system, General Conference, a legislative body, writes the bylaws. And it is modeled after the Constitutional Congress of the United States of America. So in the same era, in the 1700s, that we wrote the Constitution for the United States, we also wrote a process for the Methodist system. How's that? And there are three bodies. Shocker. Executive, legislative, right, and judicial. The job of the judicial council, like the job of the Supreme Court or any court system, is to rule on whether or not the laws and the Constitution were followed, not whether or not they were right. So judges and judicial councils don't decide right and wrong, they decide that the rules were or were not followed. So far, so good. The executive branch, which is the bishops of the church, are like governors of the state, in essence, if you kind of do some parallels, because the president of the United States is a little different because there's one over the entire United States. Whereas in the United Methodist Church, there is no one bishop over everything. Every bishop is over a geographical region, and their job is to preside and direct and enforce the Book of Discipline. Now, we have had a lot of debate over whether the bishops are doing a good job or a bad job. And bishops are elected in regions called jurisdictions. And there are five jurisdictions in the United States. And then there's another series called Central Conferences internationally, which do a similar thing. So there's a section of Africa that elects bishops. There's another section of Africa that elects bishops. There's a section in Europe that elects bishops. And in the United States, there are five jurisdictions. We're part of the North Central Jurisdiction. So our bishops are always elected within geographically from what's called the annual conference. And the annual conference is similar to states. So if you think of it, the Midwest elects bishop, our bishop, right, or a group of bishops. And then they are appointed or assigned by a committee within all of that. for which bishops go where. Now, that's kind of like I'm doing Methodist 101 here, right? So we can come back to all that later. What's important for today's discussion for me to help you with is to understand that just like people from Ohio cannot decide who is governor of California, okay? We can hate it, but we can't decide it. We cannot decide what the state laws in Georgia are. We can hate it, we can talk about it, but we can't decide it. In the United Methodist Church, each annual conference, East Ohio and West Ohio, and each jurisdiction have boundaries over which actions they can do and they can't do as a body. And only General Conference can write the rules for everybody in the United Methodist Church under the Book of Discipline. Except, always an exception, that the first part of the Book of Discipline is our Constitution. And the Constitution also, like the Constitution of the United States, declares rights and responsibilities. Again, the Constitution does not decide whether or not you're a murderer. The Constitution does not decide whether or not, or what taxes you pay. The Constitution does not decide your apportionments, but the Constitution does decide what bishops do, what jurisdictions do, what annual conferences do, what clergy do, what membership means, and who has what rights and privileges, but just as important, responsibilities. There are balances of power. So bishops do not actually have absolute authority. A bishop cannot remove a clergy person. A bishop decides where clergy persons are deployed, kind of like generals, right? But what the bishop can't decide is who's in and out of the army. You kind of following me? Bishops, the board of ministry of an annual conference decides who will be ordained and who will be an elder. The bishops ordain them and spiritually guide them, and they can make your life wonderful or miserable, right? So you might, you know, say like, you know, oh God, why did you appoint me to Lexington? I mean, oh, these people, you know, just like Moses, these stiff-necked people. God, why did you do this? So the idea is that the bishops are responsible for deployment and to enforce the discipline and in a way become kind of like prosecuting attorneys, that if somebody is violating the rules, they bring to the board of ministry a charge against the person and then that person there. Now, there are different rules for local pastors and elders, and there's all sorts of tiers, and it's like a lot of other stuff, right? So, like, let's try this another way. A hospital cannot decide whether or not a doctor's a doctor. But a hospital can only use doctors in certain ways. You kind of with me? All of those complexities are part of our current dilemma. Because in common talk, and especially in people who have grown up in a congregational system in which a local congregation has absolute say over everything, they want United Methodists to operate like we're congregational and vote in and vote out pastors or do different things, and it just doesn't work that way. That's not how we function because of who we are and what our background is. The other part of this is that in the United Methodist Church, when General Conference meets, we are truly a worldwide church. And you may be shocked to know this, but over half of the delegates are not from the United States. So our constitutional Congress is not just from the 13 colonies, but it also includes other countries, if you will. And when we talk about modifying a constitution or making those types of changes, that process has to go all the way around the world and takes 2 years to work through. It's a very large system. About 6 years ago or so, I'm looking at some numbers that I printed and they updated. There were something like 13 million persons who were part of the United Methodist Church. You hear that number? And one half of them are in the United States and one half of them are not. This is why we've been so successful. But as you get larger, decision-making becomes more complicated because understandings around issues like homosexuality or property rights or local congregational rights are very different in, believe it or not, just so you understand this, we have a bishop who was over both Russia and Ukraine. I have a colleague who serves on the board of on the General Council of Finance and Administration, a committee chair, who is in Denmark, right? And so those perspectives are very different than my perspectives. And that's good, because God is bigger than one country. But the dilemma becomes when you address an issue or a social concern that one country or one region is concerned about, and then you try to put it into a worldwide situation, we end up being a little bit more like the Roman Catholic Church, where life gets complicated because everything we do has to be translated into four or five languages, and the words have to line up. Now, I'm saying all that not to say that any one issue is right or wrong, but in the midst of all of that, that happens. So what happened was that in the midst of the recent pandemic that was global, in order to hold our general conference, which we hold every 4 years, one half of the delegation had to get travel visas and get permission to fly into the United States through the United States government and through their government when COVID shut down all travel. I'm just saying this now. Now, people have said, well, the bishops are just manipulating this and we could just have a vote on the whatever. And the answer is, you can't change the way you vote. Imagine our presidential election if we now said everybody can vote electronically from home. Right? And some people say, well, we have the technology to do that in our area. I don't understand why you don't have the technology to do that. Even in Ohio, we do not have equal internet access. When you start doing that worldwide, what happens is you get lagging response times, you get all sorts of times. So yes, we can have meetings. Yes, we can do ministry together. Yes, we can plan events. But when you get down to voting on changing critical components of who we are, the only way we can change the rules is when General Conference meets. Now, if Congress could not meet for the next 3 years, we would all say hallelujah at one level, right? But at another level, when your state parks and your national parks couldn't function because their budget went out and it couldn't be renewed until all the Congress persons could travel into Congress, you with me? Suddenly things fall apart. So we've actually hit this wall where we can't even elect bishops. We finally have worked through that, and this November we'll be able to elect bishops again, but because of the pandemic, it has been such a hard thing. And people say, well, why can't they just get travel visas? And I would say, like, have you talked to anybody who traveled internationally in the last 3 years? It's a mess. And different countries have different time periods, and it's all there. Now, having said that, during the last time General Conference met, we had come to the realization as a United Methodist Church that a significant part of our church, absolutely on the issues of human sexuality, we had reached an impasse where people were not going to agree. And some have said we are at a point where we can't even agree to disagree. So a paragraph in the Book of Discipline was passed to try to peacefully and gracefully allow a separation to happen. And what is at issue here is that in our United Methodist tradition also, no church property, every church property is operated and funded and owned by the local congregation, but only as long as it's doing so in trust of its part of being a United Methodist congregation. And the trust clause doesn't say conference owns your stuff. What it says is that your board of trustees are operating in trust of the worldwide United Methodist Church as well as the local congregation. And if they ever stop being this local congregation, that responsibility transfers to the annual conference's trustees, because this is and will always be a United Methodist Church. That's the trust clause. The trust clause does not say conference owns the church. The trust clause is the conference becomes, the church becomes a burden, if you will, to the conference trustees if you ever try to be something other than United Methodist. And a paragraph was passed that would allow an orderly way for those who wanted to leave the denomination for reasons only around human sexuality, no other reason, not because they don't like the bishop or the pastor they got or all the other reasons people may want to leave, but only around human sexuality could persons leave if they're at that point, because we've acknowledged that impasse. Following me so far. But then, and here's the catch, that had a timeline with it. And people stayed trusting that the next general conference could fix some things. And then the next general conference didn't meet and will not be meeting until 2024. And because the timeline of that original legislation will expire before 2024, the Wesley Covenant Association, which is becoming the Global Methodist Church, I think I've got that right, which in Ohio was originally the East Ohio Evangelical Fellowship, or has roots in that process. In other words, the very evangelical side of the church has felt an urgency to move forward with the process regardless of when General Conference is meeting again. And in that process, there has become a real distrust and an animosity that has built that we're trying to diffuse. So what I will do is answer questions in a minute about details, but I want you to understand that context. There are two different major paragraphs in the Book of Discipline that allow a congregation, allow an annual conference to transfer trust and responsibility for facilities. One of the paragraphs is this special paragraph created around human sexuality. And the other one is a paragraph that has always existed, in which an annual conference may sell property or vote or close or discontinue a local congregation. And in a civil way, especially if that congregation is in an area where the annual conference acknowledges we can't do ministry there effectively any longer, but somebody else can, then we may say, well, the Lutherans or the Baptists or somebody else needs to do the ministry there because we just can't staff it, for lack of better understanding. That paragraph has always existed, right? But that requires a different process. In both processes, what must be cared for is the financial responsibilities into the next 30 years of what the impact will be on all the other United Methodist churches if this congregation leaves. Not in terms of apportionments, but in terms of pension funding and other things, because if you remember what happened in the United States around steel and the steel plants closing, and then suddenly people didn't have their pensions anymore. And that's called a pension liability. Now here's where we are different, because the United States pension rules and pension rules anywhere else in the world are different. And this is where things don't make sense. Okay, I'm gonna stop. So you may have heard from people, and recently the Wesley Covenant Association has set up a whole group of meetings telling people you gotta get out now because you can't wait till next general conference. So if you wanna disaffiliate, now's the time. And our bishop, in her graciousness, has said, if that is where you are as a congregation, then you can work with your district superintendent and we'll help you understand the process you have to follow to do that. But we will not have you do that because three or four people are driving the engine. It has to be because the congregation really understands the whole process, and the congregation is making the decision, not a few people for the congregation. Making sense so far? That's a hard line to cut, but that's where we are. Now, having said that, I don't know where folks here are, what conversations you've had, but what I will say is that the word that we've been using is compatible and incompatible. So one of the questions has come up as well, if we stay in the United Methodist Church, what's going to happen? And it's kind of like, well, if so-and-so is elected president, what's going to happen? Oh, the economy's going to get better, everything's going to go your way, and we're going to make a lot of promises. So when we're promising the future, we need to be a little careful. But what I can say is this, it is pretty evident that the United Methodist Church and the colleagues I know of are going to continue a ministry that includes some level of relationship with LGBTQ communities. And kind of like Father Michael in this situation I talked about, that may or may not be sometimes at odds or intention. Well, one of the questions is, well, we can be nice to them, but can they be ordained? When you get into that now, you understand that we started creating the Gentiles and, you know, the sinners and the not sinners and who can be ordained, right? So the question really becomes around issues of ordination, around issues of marriage. And the other driver that really fueled the timing of this is when the Supreme Court of the United States, not to be confused with the Judicial Council of the United Methodist Church, but similar body, ruled that the Constitution of the United States, not to be confused with the Constitution of the United Methodist Church, but a similar structure, right? Required that you could not treat marriage among same-sex persons differently than marriage among homosexual persons. I can give you all the court cases, doesn't matter. We all know it's there. Now here's our dilemma. Once that happened, United Methodist pastors were suddenly stuck because the United States laws no longer governed whether we married or didn't marry somebody. We now had to use church law, and the church law doesn't say a thing about it. Right? So then General Conference needs to meet to decide what the church's positions are, and General Conference is in a stalemate, kind of following where we are. And so some persons have said, it's very obvious to them that in the future the United Methodist Church is going to openly permit, some have said. We don't know what the future is going to be. I can tell you, I cannot predict what happens when you get 600 people together to vote. And if you say you can, I question some things. The reality is we don't know. But what I will say is this, this debate is not going to be over. I recently filled in a United Church of Christ, and they've been in the debate for more than 10 or 15 years, and local congregations still have not settled. I'm just going to tell you that, right? So we know that if people disaffiliate, when they're disaffiliating, one of the questions I would ask is, well, what are you going to do that's so different that that stance has now made you a better church? Are you going to have a better youth group? Are you going to have a better Bible study? You know, we already have those networks and supports and resources. Can we be a church that allows local congregational rule to a degree, local conversation, right, but will not be reactive if another United Methodist congregation has marriage for gay persons? Kind of. So these are the kind of questions we're getting into. What if we have a pastor who marries somebody but not in our facility? Right? What I can tell you already is pastors marry divorced persons, and there was a time in our church, in the EB church that I grew up in, where pastors left the ministry because they got divorced. Pastors marry persons who are multiracial, different races, right? There was a time when you would be thrown out of the church for that. And I know pastors who want to evaluate the loving relationship of a gay couple and determine if they can be married based on the loving relationship, not on their sexuality. And I know other pastors who say, absolutely, the Bible is clear. But I will ask, if the Bible is clear about that, why isn't it clear about divorce? I mean, what's our biblical understanding? And this is where the deadlock is. Okay, enough's enough. So what questions do you have based on where I am? And one of the questions is, what happens to the assets of the church? And the answer is, well, it depends on how we vote. But how we vote will be through a charge conference. That's what I will tell you. And if you want to do that. So what questions do you have now? Let me open this up, because I don't know how much of this you've known, but that was my quick introduction. Okay, let's ask.
Question.
Yes. Do you have to receive them? Do you have to receive a minister who is a same-sex marriage? Is what you're asking? Okay. I've had a little deja vu on this, by the way. As a district superintendent, I received paperwork on a pastor from the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America as they transferred into our system. And when I looked at the questions, I thought, boy, the United Methodist Church doesn't know what's coming, but it's coming soon. And the answer is, all appointments are in consultation with that local congregation. So the relationship and the honesty and openness of communication you have with the district superintendent and the bishop will guide that process. Bishop. And this is where the trust level becomes in. He said, who makes the final decision? And the answer is the bishop makes the appointment. That's our system. Now, if you don't know this, this already happens to a degree around person's stance on biblical interpretation. And sometimes it happens well, and sometimes it doesn't. So one of the incompatibility questions is, if that is an absolute hard thing that this congregation says, if that ever happens, we're done, right? That's one of the reasons some people may want to disaffiliate. What I would say is, I know people who took that position on divorce and now are in a different place. So over time, what I don't know, right, is what I would say is the openness of the conversation and the honesty of the communication makes a difference. I was talking with somebody in Texas, so you're safe, in which they were upset with me because they had a pastor whom they loved dearly, who got removed from an appointment, went into recovery and rehab for a major problem with alcoholism, and then was not reappointed back to that local church, but to a different church. And they were irate because they thought the pastor should go back to that local church. And I said, what you're telling me is that in the confidentiality of conversations the bishop had with that pastor, you're not acknowledging that maybe there was something in that local church. I don't want you to all confuse us with how much I got, but I want to say this. In the quality of the conversation, sometimes bishops know and pastors have shared things that we don't. I'm back to this one. If a pastor is in a same-sex marriage and this congregation is absolutely clear that this would be a hostile place for that pastor to be, the bishop would be foolish to send that pastor into that setting. But if there are a few members in the congregation who feel that way and the rest of the congregation wants to be opening and confirming, you're in the same boat that a lot of people are in, which is that we as a congregation haven't come to our understanding. So the quality of the conversation in the congregation becomes the driver for that appointed process, rather than three people making a decision without knowledge. That's where we're at. So the bishop has the final statement, but I'm going to tell you right now, the bishops struggle and superintendents really struggle, not only over this, but over a lot of other issues. I hate to say this, but I still had churches who was telling me they didn't want a woman. And I thought, after all these years, you got to be kidding me. Right?
Your explanation is really good. What about the divorce law? Not just the United States, but the world. I mean, this phenomenon of justification seems to be somewhat globalized.
It's globalized because it has financial implications.
What is the European and African?
So the African bishops sent out a letter this week. He talked about, what about the world situation? The African bishops united in a letter this week, and I'm not sure whom else, that basically said that they do not support disaffiliation. However, that doesn't mean they support gay marriage. So what that means is that the delegation who goes to the next general conference may be just as conservative as it's always been. We don't know what the general conference is going to do. They want to wait until General Conference because they want to understand until General Conference meets, there is no position to defend against. So they said, let's slow down and do that. Let's wait. Let's not rush it. Now, some people are concerned that if this other paragraph deadline has passed, that they can't disaffiliate after that. And my answer is, I trust General Conference that they will extend some pots, that there will be an option in the future somehow. I don't know what it'll be. And it will always involve making sure that you've met your pension obligations, your financial obligations. Quick statement, people don't realize this. Your trustees and your church financial persons may have to pause and think about this for a minute. But every piece of property you own, every trailer, every whatever, is registered either in a courthouse or with the Secretary of State. You have a tax-exempt status with the federal government. You have bank accounts. If you suddenly become not United Methodist, every one of those legal documents has to be transferred in a legal process that is similar to when you sell your house to another person. Even if you're all the same people, but you stop being a United Methodist, at that point, those documents all say the United Methodist Church. So if you become a Global Methodist or a Baptist or anything else or Independent Congregational or the Community Church of Lexington, there then is a whole series of actions that have to happen to register the new organization's name with all of those legal processes in the United States. And that is part of why you absolutely, if you're going to do that, you want to work with the district superintendent to do that in a way that isn't going to get legally challenged down the road. And we're willing to help you with that. But that's part of it. Now, when you go to the global level, the question is not around legal processes because every country has its own laws around property. So Africa laws, property laws don't apply to the United States. The United States don't apply to Africa or Europe, right? So then the next big question is, what about the Book of Discipline itself and the rule book? And one of the proposals at the next general conference, and it's been around for years, but because of this stalemate, it's been blocked for years, has been to create regional books of discipline, which maybe the United States can have a different book of discipline than Europe, right? A core discipline around the Apostles' Creed and around our commitment to the United Methodist global structure, but different regional rules. And again, for that to happen, it could become constitutional. And if it becomes constitutional, then every annual conference has to vote on it. So General Conference has to approve it, and then every annual conference has to vote on it, and then the Constitution can be changed, kind of like the United States.
Mm-hmm. What happens to that pastor who has been assigned to the church through the process?
So in a local church, there are three levels of membership. So when a local church disaffiliates, what happens? And the answer is the disaffiliation, just like when a local church closes or merges, I'm going to put it this way, okay? What happens then is that that new body has to be established, right? All the assets have to be transferred. And then all of the membership has to be offered the opportunity to continue in that local, new local church or be transferred to another United Methodist church. And in the same way, all of the clergy have to determine where they want to be and if they want to move, regardless of whether the local church does this. So your pastor can say, as an individual, just like you as an individual could say, you know what, I've had enough of this. I want to transfer my membership to the Lutheran Church. I want to transfer my membership to the Baptist Church. Pastors can transfer their membership. So what happens in a disaffiliation process is that it forces that decision-making process, and every individual has to decide whether or not they're going to move to another United Methodist Church or remain, or if you vote not to move. So this is my point. You don't have to vote, but if you all just say as a church, folks, we're going to wait till the next general conference, we are not going to disaffiliate, you can do that. Once you say that, there might be four or five members who say, that's it, I've had enough, and then they can move their membership. A pastor may say that. I know some clergy who have said, if their church doesn't move, they're moving. Once that happens, right, and we've determined who is aligned in what way with what position or teaching, then the bishop and the superintendent have a job to do, which is to redo the appointment. That's a lot of redoing. And that's a lot of redoing because we are incompatible with that another annual conference ordained a gay person or another church did whatever. But having said that, I don't discount that. If that is how strongly people feel, this is where our bishop is, if you cannot sleep knowing that the United Methodist Church's position on homosexuality somehow will misrepresent who Jesus is, then we'll work with you to find a faith community within the greater Christian tradition. And whether it is Global Methodist or not is actually not the issue. Because you can disaffiliate not to the Global Methodist Church. You could join the Wesleyan Church. This congregation could say, we want to talk with our superintendent and we want to become Lutheran. All right? I mean, however, I will say that the Global Methodist Church is saying, but they represent common roots. Well, so does the Wesleyan Church. Yeah, I mean, there are other groups and bodies. If you disaffiliate with the Global Methodist Church, the pension process will be neater because it's already within the WestPath pension system. So how we transfer pension systems and assets may be slightly different. The mechanisms are different. That's part of what's at stake here. Others. Oh, by the way, the process, if you want to know this, if any congregation wants, it feels like that's where you are, you have a conversation with your congregation, and then your church counselor, church board says, not that we want to disaffiliate, but that this is serious enough that we want to go to all the effort involved to find out about more detail, right? And then you contact the district superintendent through your pastor, and then your district superintendent comes down and they assure that the entire congregation is in the conversation, not just the board, right? Not just a few people. And then you schedule a charge conference, and then you find out in dollars and cents, you can do this any time you want to do this, what is the pension obligation that we're going to have? What are the financial implications, right? But this is not a simple process. What's the timeline? And then you schedule a charge conference like you would if you were buying a building or selling your building and moving to another building, because you're selling your building at that point, in essence, even if you transfer it for zero. You know, it's like if I give my house to my children, I have to do a legal process of transferring it. So you have to have a charge conference to transfer property. And then, based on the vote of that charge conference, you see, because it's still not done until there's a vote, you have to meet that threshold. And then if you've met that threshold, then all the other processes happen. So far, so good. You're following all that? So it's about it's a multi-month to a year process. So folks are saying right now that to get that all done by the deadline, you all better do it by January. That's the letter that's going out. So people are pushing to get this going because they feel that strongly. If this congregation says, you know what, we're uneasy, but we're willing to wait till General Conference to figure out where we are, then that's a relief. And it's like, come on, let's just, we're doing good. We have good ministries. Let's focus on our ministries and not on that process. That's a possibility of what you can decide. Or you can say, it's time, this is it. And there are some folks who have said, this is it.